And my belief is, and what I've seen time and time again in research and practice, is the way that we alchemize the most profoundly difficult and traumatizing and unfair things that happen to us is we figure out how to take that experience and transmute it into something that is not only positive, but allows us to make the world a better place or to share a positive message with the world. So now I get to take this yucky goo of PTSD and stalker and tell a hopeful story about coming through this trauma, about how it has shaped me, about how it's allowed me to show up as a better person. And in doing so, that reinforces my own resilience narrative. And it also shines a light for people who are beginning that journey or somewhere on that path to give them hope.
Welcome to the Alchemist Lounge. What if you could hang out with high-performing executives, entrepreneurs, and leaders? Ask them about how psychedelics have impacted their self-improvement journeys. Then take an insight or two to guide your own growth. Each week, Alex Atwood takes an in-depth look at how psychedelics can increase fulfillment, solve personal problems affecting your career, and help you gain the success you seek. Alex is an executive and psychedelics coach to high performers, and his goal is to provide strategies to help you reduce conflict, bring awareness, and balance your life through the use of psychedelics. Now, here's Alex.
Today's guest is Dr. Taryn Marie. She is an executive coach, a keynote speaker, an author, a mom, traveler, and a philanthropist. She's also the chief resilience officer at Resilience Leadership Institute. And her work is all about supporting people in recognizing their worth, believing in themselves, and teaching them to be more resilient so they can reach their full potential. Dr. Taryn Marie, are you there?
Alex, I'm here.
Hi, welcome to the show.
Yeah. Thank you. I'm so delighted to be here. Look, I'm in the Alchemist Lounge.
Yes, and we have a true alchemist here today, so you can't do any better than that.
Is it you?
No, it's you and me. We're all alchemists in one way or another, aren't we? If we really dig in, we'll discover it. So let's jump in. So I was looking through your post, or I could lurking through your post. I saw a post that said the difference between planning and preparing for success, right? Mm-hmm. So I want to hear a little bit about, like, what is the difference between planning and preparing for success?
Yeah. You know, and there's such a fine line between looking and lurking, isn't there? I love that.
There is.
I love that distinction. Yeah. You know, it's interesting that you asked this question because a version of it was coming up for me in my head recently. And how it sounded in my head was, don't let your dreams get in the way of your success, right? Like, what does that mean? And what it means to me is sometimes our dreams are so big and bold and audacious. And sometimes there's a very far sort of distance, at least in our own minds, between where we are today and that dream. And sometimes when where we are today and that dream are very far away, it can feel overwhelming or scary, or like we have delusions of grandeur. You know, it can be like, do I deserve this? Am I just fooling myself that I can get, you know, all those things, right? And so I think it's beautiful and wonderful to have really big dreams. And also, like, don't let those dreams get in the way of our success, your success, because then I think what we get to do is we get to, like, sort of not scale back the ultimate dream, right? But then to say, okay, like, what's the next immediate step I can take, right? Like, sort of the philosopher who says, like, a journey of 1,000 miles, you know, starts with a single step, right? And I think your question about planning and preparation are the same thing, right? Like, I plan to achieve this big dream, right? Okay. And now what are the building blocks? What are the things I'm going to put into place sort of in this 3D world in linear time to actually prepare to make that happen. And I'll just say one more thing about that. I know that this is like a long-winded answer. The other thing that I would like to say about that is, I think we also get to think about not just like, what are we going to do, right? Like, how are we going to operationalize that, if you will? I think we also get to, and this is as important, if not more important, in my humble opinion, I think we also get to really reflect on who we get to be or would need to be in order to step into that big dream. Right? Like, what is the version of ourself that we get to be? And then how can we bring people around us that are going to uplift us and hold us to a higher standard?
Yeah. So what it sounds like to me is that preparing is taking action, doing in the world. We're planning is that dream, is that sort of long-term, right? Preparing has you actually do something in the world to make that long-term plan become a reality. I know somebody I'd worked with long ago had this thing on the wall. It said, plan your work and work your plan, right? And so that was just so simple, but it was super impactful for me. Yeah. And so thank you. What a great explanation. So I want to learn more about you. I want to learn more about how you have this very unique perspective and ability to build such resilience in others and how you've sort of devoted your life to that. It seems like a very noble purpose. So tell me, what was your childhood like and where did you grow up?
So I grew up in Ann Arbor, Michigan, which for those listening in the United States, some of you might know it. Some of you internationally might know it. It's a college town. It's where the University of Michigan is located. Because I grew up there, I didn't appreciate what a unique and beautiful place that is in Michigan. And so like many people growing up, you know, I wanted to go away for college. I wanted to see something new and to be in a new environment. And that did not work out for me. You know, I grew up in a family, you know, we didn't have a lot of money. We always had enough, but my mom stayed home with us. And so it turned out that for the caliber of university and the investment of in-state tuition, that was the right place for me to go. And, you know, I had a lovely time at the University of Michigan. And, you know, you asked about my childhood. You know, it's interesting. On the one hand, I would say a very loving parents. My mother didn't work when we were growing up, so she devoted herself to being the room mother and the, you know, Girl Scout leader and, you know, all the things. On the other hand, things changed dramatically for me at age 14. And at age 14, I was a freshman in high school. And I happened to, in the month of October, which is when we're recording this podcast, I happened to be getting ready for school one morning to catch the bus. And it's, you know, dark early in the morning, like, you know, 6 before 7 o'clock. And I was in my ground floor bedroom. And my window was open about this much with the shades down the rest of the way to kind of get that crisp fall air. I always love that. And after I had finished getting dressed for school, I went over to my stereo to turn off the music I was, you know, listening to. And, you know, for those of you that don't know what a stereo is, you can see me after. We didn't always play music from our phones. Just, I know your minds are exploding right now. And I can also talk to you about what a butter churn is. We can go deep.
Or turntable.
That's right. Yeah. And so I went over and there was a space at the bottom of, like, pressed so close. It's dark outside, but there's light from my room. And I'm like, what in the world? And so in my 14-year-old mind, I'm flipping through my Rolodex, right? Around, like, how do I make sense of this? And what I remembered was a time, I think it was around Halloween too, where my dad went outside and he was like doing something to scare my brother and I. So I was like, that must be what it is. My dad's playing a trick on me. And so I was like, Dad? And the face was like, take off your clothes, you're beautiful. And I was like, not Dad. So I run from my room. I'm like terrified. I have that feeling like, I don't watch horror movies anymore because my life has been scary enough. But when I get scared, when I'm watching a movie, it's like the walls start to close in, you know, it was like that. Like I could, you know, so I like make a break for it.
Yeah.
We call the police. The police take down the report and they're all, okay, we think this is just someone passing through the neighborhood, really nothing to worry about, probably a fluke, right? So I'm like, all right, that sounds good. So 8 months pass. Now we're in June of the next year. I'm keeping this window closed. We have another, window in the back of the house that just faces, you know, the backyard. And this window is open. I've gone shopping with my girlfriends and I just took off my clothes. And so now I'm naked and I hear his voice again. And wow. He says, I've been waiting a long time for this. And for me, three things became true in that moment, right? One, my childhood bedroom, which should have been one of the safest places for me, should be a safe place for anyone. And unfortunately, for a variety of reasons that, you know, sometimes isn't, became profoundly unsafe, right? Two, I'm naked in front of a man for the first time. And three, I'm like, this is not a fluke. So this, you know, moment really became the inflection point where I was like, you know, Houston, we have a problem here. And what emerged was like, he became this stalker who came periodically, whose behavior escalated each time to the point where he was attempting to break into our home when I was home alone. I was babysitting for another family in the neighborhood and came to that house one time. And, you know, fast forward to my time at University of Michigan, my mom calls me early one morning and a neighbor has been arrested for brutally raping and assaulting another woman in our neighborhood. And we believe that, you know, is likely the same person, right? And so he goes to prison for 20 years. And I too spent time in captivity because what I realized in my early 20s was I met all of the diagnostic criteria for post-traumatic stress disorder. And so that was a 2 decades journey of healing that trauma and sort of sense of betrayal of my safety. And so, you know, one of the things that I've realized, right, is I've looked outside of myself for examples of resilience. I've done all kinds of research, qualitative and quantitative, with people that have had brain injuries and spinal cord injuries, with leaders, with elite athletes, with women who are living in rural areas and experiencing food insecurity or financial insecurity with their families, like all people of all walks of life. And I believe if you'd asked me maybe a couple of years ago, like when did this whole resilience thing start? I would have said graduate school. And now looking back, I think, you know, resilience and I met a lot earlier than that. You know, we Absolutely. Met when I was 14 in my bedroom.
Wow. What a terrifying experience. And as you mentioned, that's a sacred space there. That's a container, especially at that age. That's where you get on the bed and you sing into your hairbrush and you just be as goofy as you want. And I can remember all the things that I did there. And then being a young woman and having to go through that, clearly it provided fuel later on for you to be able to do what you do now. But how long did it take before it really settled in, you know, as a teenager, going through all of the angst that a teenager goes through and then having that be a part of that? Did that impact the relationships you had, you know, your friends, the way you saw maybe men or boys at that time?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, it impacted all of that, although I didn't realize the full complement of what was being impacted at the time until much later, until I ameliorated the symptoms of PTSD. Because, you know, at 14, you know, to your point, we're singing into our hairbrushes and getting crushes on people. And so then, you know, I don't know exactly sort of what the inception point was for kind of like meeting the diagnostic criteria for PTSD, but that became very much a part of me as I was maturing and growing into an adult. So I didn't know what it felt like to be, you know, a teenager or an adult without these symptoms and this experience until, you know, kind of my early 30s. Right. Mm-hmm. So it impacted things that I was aware of, like, you know, I was very afraid of the dark. I was very afraid to stay home by myself. you know, I didn't want to be like left alone with people that I didn't know, you know, that type of thing. And it also impacted my life in ways that I didn't necessarily notice or realize until, you know, kind of much later on.
Mm. Wow. Wow. That's something to happen at that age. So you mentioned that growing up in the Midwest, went to an in-state school, and there was something else that had happened, you said, in graduate school that you felt was the catalyst for the resilience. So what happened there?
Yeah. You know, I think, you know, like if you had asked me, you know, maybe 2 years ago, like, when did you get interested in this whole resilience thing? Right. Like I would have pointed to graduate school and said like, oh, well, you know, I got involved in this project with like mothers living in rural Maryland and looking at what were the kind of facets of their experience that allowed them to sort of harness and demonstrate greater resilience when they were living with like financial and or food insecurity, right? Mm-hmm. And then I did pre and postdoctoral fellowships in neuropsychology, where I was really focused on treating people that had brain injuries and spinal cord injuries and thinking not just about the physical rehabilitation, which many hospitals are very good at, but also the relational, the emotional, the social rehabilitation of an individual, right? Their significant partner relationship and more broadly for their family. And it wasn't until I was really reflecting when I was writing my book, The Five Practices of Highly Resilient People, which will be out next year, where I was like, I have this perspective that a couple things, right? One, resilience is the essence of what it means to be human, right? So resilience isn't something we have to go find, go get, go whatever. Like it's already deeply ingrained in the sort of fabric of our humanity. And I think that's a really important departure from the way that a lot of people are thinking about resilience, because a lot of people are thinking about resilience as either binary, right? Like I'm resilient or I'm not, right? Mm-hmm. And we're also thinking about resilience sort of in the wrong way when we think about it as being something that's outside of ourselves that we have to go find and cultivate and kind of bring back. And so, you know, I like to say that we don't find resilience. Resilience finds us, as because it's a part of the essence of what it means to be human. You know, you and I and everyone listening to this episode, like we all made it, you know, like we've all lived through every like health diagnosis, loss, disappointment, rejection, turn of events. Like there's no question that we're resilient. Mm-hmm. And so for me, I would have said like, oh, I went and, you know, found resilience in graduate school. And it was like, no, wait, it was with me long before that. And actually it's with all of us, mm-hmm. right? As an element of the essence of what it means to be human. Mm-hmm.
So it's something you discover over time as life throws challenges your way. So you grew up in the Midwest. You started to work with those that are underserved. And do you see what happened in your childhood having a big influence on that in terms of when you're working with people that are from maybe a marginalized community or are in situations where they could be in dire financial straits? Aside from looking at the data and being able to help those with their physical outwardly needs, did you hone in on maybe some of the internal needs that might be there, maybe trying to sort of turn the key to the resilience ignition? Did you find yourself doing that in that work?
Yeah. One of the things that I wanted to understand, so if resilience is the essence of being human, right, then the human experiences of challenge, change, and complexity are really, I think, the fabric of our shared human experience, right? And what I've noticed is that oftentimes when we experience challenge, change, or complexity, what happens is people can feel ashamed about that or less than, or sort of take on the tenor of the challenge, like as though they're experiencing challenge because they've done something wrong, right? And bad and hard and difficult things do happen to good people, right? So I was meeting with a CEO of a cryptocurrency company that I'm currently coaching. And he was talking about the volatility in the marketplace. And he was like, you know, I've been a good person and I've given back to society and I'm developing my leaders and I'm a pillar of my community. So like, why do I have to go through this crap? You know, like what gives? And I was like, you know what? You're so right. And if that's the way that life worked, you would not be wrong. But challenge, change, and complexity don't work like that. We don't get to engineer those experiences out of our lives. And candidly, we don't want to, because those are the moments when we learn the most about ourselves. Those are the moments when we gain a greater sense of compassion and empathy and wisdom and strength. And I'm like, oh my God, I never thought I'd be able to rise to this occasion, but here I am doing it, putting one foot in front of the next. And so, you know, to sort of put a finer point on this from like from an alchemy standpoint, you know, I think this is how we alchemize challenge, change, and complexity. We move from it being this like profoundly negative experience and something we didn't want and candidly hope to avoid to, I can see now, right? Even though I didn't choose this circumstance, I can see the good in it, right? I can see how it's changed me for the better, how it's, you know, shined a light on something in my life that has now been enhanced. And so I think that's the first part. And then the second part is anytime we go through something difficult, right? Like take my experience with a stalker and PTSD, for example, it's like really hard to kind of like find a pony in there. It's like really hard to like be like, okay, so I know there's something good in here, you know, somewhere, right? And my belief is, and what I've seen time and time again in research and practice, is the way that we alchemize the most profoundly difficult and traumatizing and unfair things that happen to us is we figure out how to take that experience and transmute it into something that is not only positive, but allows us to make the world a better place or to share a positive message with the world. So now I get to take this yucky goo of PTSD and stalker and tell a hopeful story about coming through this trauma, about how it has shaped me, about how it's allowed me to show up as a better person. And in doing so, that reinforces my own resilience narrative. And it also shines a light for people who are beginning that journey or somewhere on that path to give them hope, right? And to allow them to move out of that sort of shameful, dark, silent place to be like, oh, I could maybe like talk about my story too, and that would be okay.
Mm. There's such alchemy there. You know, it reminds me, I read recently the story that Michael J. Fox had written, and he was 29 at the time when he was one of the, you know, biggest movie stars in the world, had an, you know, incredible career, had just married the love of his life. And he felt a twitch in his right pinky that changed his entire life. And when they asked him at that time, they, you know, that twitch led to Parkinson's, which then gave him a purpose in his life. And there was a question asked to him when he was talking about his story that had, if someone were to tell you that they would be able to change the past 10 years of your life and take away the Parkinson's, what would you say? And he'd say, no way, forget it. My life is so much more rich and I have such nourishment, and where I had anxiety and I had material success that felt that it was at times unmanageable and unsustainable, suddenly I have purpose. And so, you know, I thought about that and I said, you know, what a brilliant example of massive adversity turning into such an opportunity to find a, you know, a purpose in life. And so, and I've heard that time and time again. I was just working with a former C-suite executive in a large hospitality company, and he found out that he was losing his eyesight to be completely blind. And so he stopped his job and he went on a spiritual path. And now he's found that it's one of the greatest things that had ever happened to him. So I hear that time and time again, that story of resilience. And I, you know, now that I am understanding your work, there's something called resilience leadership. And I want to understand that a little bit. What does resilience leadership mean to you?
Yeah. So one of the really exciting roles that I got to contribute in the context of, you know, business is I served as the head of executive leadership development and talent strategy at Nike for a period of time, where I got to look after the development of our C-suite. And I also got to look after the development and growth and leadership of our top 400 vice presidents in that organization and some of our athlete partners. And one of the things that was striking, I mean, there were so many striking things for me at Nike. One of the things that was striking for me was Nike's mission to serve the athlete. And then there was this little asterisk over the word athlete. And it said, if you have like a mind and a body or something, you're an athlete. Right. And I thought, well, that's interesting because not everyone identifies with being an athlete. And yet there you go, Nike, making being an athlete accessible to us all. Well done. Well done, you. And, you know, I think of the word leadership similarly. Not everyone identifies with, you know, being a leader. Yet if we sort of like put a little asterisk, you know, over leader, you know, I believe if you have like a heart and a mind, you are a leader and have the potential to be a leader. And I don't think there's anyone who doesn't have at least one other person who is looking up to them, looking to them, right? Whether you're a parent or a cousin or a, you know, an older sibling or that kind of thing. And so, you know, resilience leadership is all about how we bring the practices of resilience. So I've interviewed hundreds of people and collected thousands of pieces of data on how they effectively addressed challenges, changes, and complexities in their lives and created a more positive and productive outcome. And that's led to the five practices of highly resilient people. And so when I think about that work, it's all about the common thread of how we can face challenges, changes, and complexities to a greater degree. And so our mission is really about positively impacting the lives of 1 billion people through practical application of resilience and the five practices and the bringing of hope, healing, enhanced leadership, and increased consciousness through this work.
Hmm. Wow. Well, tell me about what are the five pillars? It was the five pillars, right?
Five practices, but pillars is good. Pillars is another good keyword, you know?
Yeah. Strength.
Yeah. I like the five pillars, you know, I'll tell you the word practice is intentional because it's this idea of like, you know, like mindfulness and like so many things, like our golf swing, right? It's a practice, you know, we're always,
like our meditation.
Growing. Like meditation.
Yeah.
We're always growing and shifting and changing. And so the five practices are, you know, based on interviewing hundreds of people and collecting thousands of pieces of data, you know, what are the five things that people said they were doing that allowed them to more effectively address, you know, these inflection points of challenge in their lives? And so the first practice is the practice of vulnerability. And the practice of vulnerability, I think the word vulnerability is probably just about as misunderstood as the word resilience, right? So by the way, the definition of resilience is facing challenge and change and complexity effectively in a way that allows us to be enhanced by that experience, not diminished. And vulnerability, the first practice of highly resilient people, you know, what did people do to effectively address challenge? Vulnerability is allowing our inside self, our thoughts, our feelings, and our experience to as closely as possible match the outside self that we're sharing with the world. In psychology, this is called congruence, right? Like how close like our internal self is to our outside itself. Now, Brené Brown, for you and others who might be familiar with her work, she talks about vulnerability as being something that's, you know, a necessary ingredient to living a wholehearted life, right? And I've walked away from her work being like, yes, and hell no. Because what is vulnerability? And that seems way too scary. And, you know, is the sort of juice worth the squeeze and all those things, right? Yeah. And then when vulnerability showed up in my own work, I was like, dang, right? Like I was both sort of motivated and convicted by this concept, like convicted because I was like, crap, like I don't really like being vulnerable. And now I get to recognize that within myself and then motivated to work on it. And so I think one of the ways that I've gotten to sort of advance this conversation is first and foremost to define what vulnerability is. I think it becomes less scary when we're like, oh, it's about having more congruence. It's about having this internal self match the external self to the greatest extent possible, knowing that that's going to be different in different environments with different people. And yet it's powerful when we face challenge for two reasons, right? One, if we have a, you know, not unlike sort of the desires that we have of today and the dreams of tomorrow, right? When those are very far away, that creates anxiety, right? When what we're feeling and experiencing in our internal self is very far away from how we're showing up externally, right? We're really running two human operating systems, right? Like we're burning a lot of energetic capital, right? To feel and experience one thing on the inside and then to project something very different on the outside. So the more that we can bring those things closer together, the less energetic capital we're going to burn. The second thing is when we allow ourselves to be vulnerable, what this does is it gives us more opportunities for people to help us, right? To get the resources, the information, the knowledge, the tools, the support for what we're going, which then allows us to more effectively face challenge. So the first practice, which is really foundational, is the practice of vulnerability and how we go about doing that. And then from a leadership standpoint, it's also really amazing because vulnerability is the fertile ground from which authenticity and empathy grow, right? So if you think about that for yourself, you know, if you as a listener thinking about that, we can't be authentic without tapping into something vulnerable within ourselves. We can't be empathetic without tapping into a connection that we have to what someone or something else is experiencing. So it's just powerful in so many ways.
Yeah. It also allows for a resonance, a relatable, you know, relatedness to those around you when you speak from a vulnerable place. It gives others, at least from my experience, a sense of empowerment in the presence of someone who's able to be vulnerable. So it opens you up. It opens others up to be able to share vulnerably. And only from that space can you really show true self-expression. And to your point, it's very difficult to keep up that facade. And the societal structures, I'll say of the past, but they continue, they almost mandate you to not be vulnerable, to not show that. And what a difficult mask that is to wear, right? And how much energy that takes. So for leaders that I've seen and that I've put into my own practice, I've found that being vulnerable is absolutely provides authenticity and it allows others to see themselves in your light. It allows others to really relate to the humanity in us all. So that's very, very powerful. What are some other practices? This is awesome.
Yeah. Thank you for that. I love everything that you said there. That was so powerful. You know, one thing I would just add is we know as humans, there's a pretty big difference between knowing and doing, right? So, you know, for anyone who has a child, when you're like, hey, and they're like, I know that, you know, and you're like, yeah, you might know that, but you don't do that, right? And you know, that exists for all of us as humans. And so if we know that vulnerability is good for us, why aren't we all running around living our most fabulous vulnerable life, our best vulnerable life? And that was a question that I also wanted to answer, you know, through my work. And something that emerged when I asked people that question is what I now call the vulnerability bias. And the vulnerability bias appears to be like a cognitive programming in our head where we have this moment where we're like, ooh, I'm going to allow myself to be seen and known, right? And then a little like voice in our head goes off and is like, that's a terrible idea. Definitely do not do that, right? And then if that weren't bad enough, the voice goes on. And the voice says, you know what, if you do that, the three L's will occur. And we're like, what are the three L's? You know, and the voice in our head, like, well, the three L's are people won't like you, they won't love you, and they might leave. And you're like, dang, voice in my head, you just threw abandonment in there. I am out. Right. And so this is basically what happens for us. We have this moment where we're like, ooh, I want to be seen and known to a greater degree. That sounds wonderful. And the voice in our head is like, that's a terrible idea. Mm. And then, you know, we're like, well, I do want people to like me. I do want people to love me. And I sure don't want people to leave, except for like maybe a couple people, they can go. But I want everyone else to stay, right? And so then we're like, okay, I'm not going to be vulnerable, right? The stakes are too high. Right. And so this is an irrational fear. And as with any irrational fear, the way that we face an irrational fear is by doing it, right? Is by stepping outside of sort of the confines of our comfort zone and pushing at the edges and trying on vulnerability amidst that fear. And then as we have a good experience, right, like doing more and more of it, right? Mm-hmm. And I'll just say, like, that's how I became my own case study. So I had this story of, you know, stalker, PTSD. Now I'm climbing the corporate ladder at like, you know, Fortune 50 companies. And my resilient story, right? And our resilient stories, we all have at least one, is the story often that we most don't want to tell and most needs to be told. And so my resilient story was the whole stalker PTSD thing. And I was like, no, I'm not going to tell anyone that. That is going to minimize or reduce my credibility. And then I learned about vulnerability. I learned about the vulnerability bias and I thought, okay, well, what if I tell people this story? Like as I'm going to human capital and HR conferences and speaking about resilience as a presenter, what if I tell people the PTSD story and I become my own case study and I see, you know, is the vulnerability bias real? Are people gonna stop liking me, stop loving me and leave? Or is that a fallacy, right? Mm-hmm. And of course, what happened was nobody left, nobody stopped liking me, nobody stopped loving me. And I got more speaking engagements and I developed deeper relationships and people said that they felt closer to me because they could see my humanity and people appreciated what I shared because it made an even greater impact in their life. And so it's like, I can speak from the perspective of what it feels like to stand up in front of a group of people and share my resilient story, the story that most needs to be told, but I'm like, I really don't want to do this. Right. Mm. And then to see what actually happens and to get to prove the vulnerability bias wrong.
Wow. So now leaders have this fertile ground mm-hmm. of vulnerability that now they can plant seeds in to be able to grow themselves, their families, their relationships, their organizations. So what are the seeds that you plant in the vulnerability, in this fertile ground of vulnerability that allows that growth to happen?
Yeah. Well, what we find is that we all have universal experiences and we all have unique experiences. And I think within the past couple of years, because we've all had such tremendously huge and impactful universal experiences, you know, pandemic, social justice, inequity, significant changes in laws and legislation, you know, seeing this incredibly I don't even have words, like see this war unfold that's like just so devastating, you know, between Ukraine and Russia, right? So we all have these, like, now we all have this like tremendous universal experience that we didn't necessarily all share as humans. Mm-hmm. We're not all, you know, in Ukraine and that kind of thing, you know, but we all have walked through many similar things. There's more emphasis now, and I think more appreciation for now sharing our unique experiences, how connected to those universal experiences. There's more emphasis on a desire to drive employees' well-being and mental health, right? To have conversations about trust and inequity and bias. And, you know, so I think that's a really wonderful thing that's emerged. And so with regard to vulnerability, like if I make that practical, right, there's a lot of really practical experiential things that I do with individuals, with teams, with organizations. One of them is this exercise that I call the reverse bucket list, right? So we all know what a bucket list is, right? It's all the pleasurable things we want to do while we're here on this earth. And I got to thinking, right, in the spirit of like, you know, challenge, change, and complexity are the fabric of our lives. I got to do some of those pleasurable things on my bucket list, and those were amazing. But I was like, you know, I learned so much more about myself when I was like going through the stuff that I had hoped to avoid, right? The opposite of the bucket list, the reverse bucket list, right? Yeah. And so one of the things that I do with people is I ask them to call up a reverse bucket list moment, right? A disappointment, a loss, a rejection, a setback, a turn of events. And to call in, right? Like you can do this for yourself, Alex, and our listeners, you know, to call in like a particular challenge or challenges, if that works for you. And then we get to reflect on how did experiencing, you know, what we went through, how has that impacted the person that we are today, right? And what we find when we have these dialogues, right, is a couple of things. One, all of a sudden we unpack vulnerability and it becomes much less scary because we know what it is, right? The second thing is we get to recognize the power that these challenges have in shaping us for the good. And so we get to drop some of that shame. And the third one is we begin to realize that we have more in common than we had imagined, right? Now, does everybody out there have like a stalker PTSD story? They do not, right? But just about everybody out there has a story about facing profound fear and uncertainty, right? Mm-hmm. And that could be speaking on a stage for the first time. That could be becoming a new parent. That could be receiving an unexpected health diagnosis. And now all of a sudden, we have experiences that bring us together more than keep us apart.
Mm. I love that. I love the reverse bucket list. I love that so much. And when you look at those experiences that shaped or that that had an impact, and you look at the opportunities that grew from that, there's really something there that can shed light on what a future created by you looks like. It's absolutely fascinating. I just love the reverse bucket list. It's almost like replace the B with an F and just forget it. That's the list. just wipe it clean. So how can someone acknowledge the stressors and challenges that have happened in their lives? Like for you, people may look at you and say, well, she's just so resilient and she's just so accomplished and she must have it all together, right? And then I learned that these are just some of the challenges. Like I learned that you have dyslexia, right? And for someone that is an author, for someone who speaks so well and is so articulate around these things, when did you learn? I mean, I'm sure you knew that early on, but was that something else that you were happy to share in that essence of vulnerability when you're out there, you know, being an author and being this thought leader?
Yeah, it's a great question. I love the question. Like the PTSD stalker story, the dyslexia and my experience with it and my willingness to share has also evolved. So that was something, well, it's interesting because when I was younger, say first and second grade, I was in the lowest reading group. and we'd go around and read aloud in class. And I was always like, oh my God, like get me a bathroom pass and like get me out of here. This is the worst, right? And so for a period of time, I believed that I just wasn't very smart, you know, that there was something wrong with me. And, you know, my peers were much smarter than I was. And, you know, as we know, dyslexia is not about intellect or intelligence or IQ. It's about how we learn and how we experience and process information. And then with everything that happened with the stalker, and I was feeling for a period of time in my life, very damaged by that. And I just couldn't bring myself to have one more thing that was quote unquote wrong with me. And so even though I did pre and post doctoral fellowships in neuropsychology, I didn't, you know, get myself tested, although I knew, right, that I was likely dyslexic. And so I taught myself some ways of reading and some workarounds in school. And fortunately, you know, my IQ was high enough that I could, you know, sort of cobble some stuff together. And so I wasn't formally diagnosed as being dyslexic until 37. And I received my doctorate degree and completed formal education, if you will, at 29, I think. Right. So I was well beyond schooling. And now, you know, it's evolved to be like, I was talking with a dear friend of mine and her son's dyslexic. And I said out loud, you know, I talked about my dyslexia out loud and I said something to the effect of like, you know, I'll type a word into Word, you know, and spelling and sequencing things is one of the things that's more difficult for me. And Word will just be like, we don't even know. Like, do you want to add it to the dictionary? Like, we've got nothing, right? But what I've learned is like, I can cut and paste that into Google. And Google's like, did you mean? And I'm like, yes, Google, I did. Like, there's a community of like dyslexic folks out there that are using Google search to figure out how to spell stuff. And I am one of them. And so he was so surprised that I talked about it out loud and that I'd accomplished all those things and I had a doctorate degree and I was writing a book. And, you know, I think in the way of this like resilient story, right, this gets to now be alchemized as instead of being something that's wrong with me, right, it gets to be something that I can talk about as an experience that I've had. It reinforces my own, you know, kind of resilience. And it also, you know, shines that light for other people who are on the journey of learning in an, you know, an atypical or being neural atypical way, and how we sort of share those stories to encourage one another.
Mm. Wow. That's fascinating. Your journey is fascinating. And thank you so much for sharing this so vulnerably. The last question I have for you, you know, so there's those that I'm sure come to you or will read your forthcoming book and be in a situation where they feel they need to find that resilience. They need to discover that resilience, right? Where it may not be just so accessible to them. And so what self-care practices do you recommend for people that might be going through a difficult time or for people that are, you know, just needing to access that resilience or that vulnerability? What's some pragmatic things you could recommend?
Yeah. You know, we talked a lot about the practice of vulnerability, and I'm so glad that we did. The second practice, just briefly, is productive perseverance. It's about sort of the art and the science of knowing when to maintain a mission or a goal in the face of challenge. And also in the face of sort of diminishing returns, how we make that decision to pivot in a new direction or to invoke our plan B. The third practice is the practice of connection. This is first and foremost the connection to ourselves, right? And also how we navigate, you know, the connection with ourselves and the inflection of the connection with others. The fourth practice is gratiosity. So being able to find gratitude in the challenge that we face, the gratty part of that. And then the osity is to share those resilient stories generously with others. We've talked quite a bit about that. And the fifth practice is the practice of possibility. First and foremost, focusing on progress over perfection. And then how we sort of navigate the relationship between possibility or sorry, the practice's possibility, but how we navigate the relationship between risk and opportunity, right, in the context of that practice. And so when I think about self-care practices, right, there's so many different ways I can go with that, right? Because there's a litany of practical things that we can do to further amplify each of the behaviors associated with the five practices. And what emerges for me is in the practice of connection, I talk a lot about how we deepen our connection to ourselves, right? And then how we also sort of navigate connections with others and perfectionism and pleasing and all those types of things. And what emerges for me is this idea of what follows I am follows you, right? And what that means is we're all constantly saying stuff to ourselves in our minds, right? And I used to think that the most important real estate that I owned was like the home that I lived in, right? And now what I realize is like the most important real estate, right, is the real estate of our own minds. And what we say to ourselves in our minds is one of the greatest predictors of who we are today and who we will become tomorrow. So in our heads, we're constantly making I am statements, right? I'm amazing. I am savvy. I am strong. I am doing my best, right? And we can also say like profoundly negative things to ourselves, right? And what I realized is there was a period of time where I was like saying stuff in my head that was so negative that I was like, you know, if I was in a relationship with someone who was like saying this to me, like they would have gotten a knuckle sandwich. And that relationship, I don't condone hitting, by the way, but a figurative knuckle sandwich. And that relationship would have been over a long time ago. So why am I staying in relationship with myself in saying these things? So when I think about self-care practices, anytime we go through hard things, I think that tendency to say negative things to ourselves and to put ourselves down can be amplified. And so being really mindful of like what follows I am in our heads, because that's what's going to follow you, right? That determines the level of confidence that we have in ourselves, the level of self-esteem, how we see our value, how we know our worth, right? So there's like 1600 things that I could tell you about self-care practices, but that's the one that like in this moment, I'm like, if you can do one thing differently, the like sort of smallest meaningful change with the highest yield outcome is to stop saying negative crap to yourself in your head. And the way that you can do that real quick is you can just get a piece of paper, draw a line down the middle, right? And start charting, like, what are the things that are coming after I am in your head? And on one side, write the things that are positive and you're proud of. And on the other side, write the things that are not, right? And then say, okay, do I commit to not doing this anymore? And what could I replace these things with that would be a more positive appraisal of who I am and what I'd like to say to myself in this moment? Mm.
Wow. What a valuable tool. Thank you for that. And to go back through the five practices, we have vulnerability, we have perseverance, we have connectedness.
Productive perseverance.
We have connectedness. I heard some gratitude there.
Gratitude plus generosity.
Oh, I like that. And then finally, we have possibility. Mm-hmm. Ah, that's beautiful. Well, I tell you, I mean, this, first of all, the way that you are able to boil things down to sort of just practical everyday things that people can do, and your way of looking at the most valuable piece of real estate as being up here in the mind really does shift things for me. So this was just such a great conversation. I cannot wait to read your book. And for those, we have in the bio, if you're watching this on YouTube, we have all of the contact information. But for those listening, how can people get in touch with you, learn more, possibly reach out?
Yeah.
What's the best way?
We've got a pretty active Instagram page at Dr. Dr. Taryn, Taryn Marie. Our website's a great place to connect. Resilience with a C, resilience-leadership.com. And the new book is The 5 Practices of Highly Resilient People. We're in pre-sale right now, and that'll go live April 18th of 2023.
Fantastic. And these practices could be pillars in what the future looks like. So that's
absolutely. They can become pillars of your life.
I love it. Thank you so much for joining. This was a fabulous call. I've learned so much, and I'm sure everyone listening has as well. And I'm looking forward to talking to you more and seeing where your journey ends up.
Thank you so much. I look forward to staying connected to you. Thank you so much.
Thanks for listening in to the Alchemist Lounge. If you enjoyed this episode and you'd like to help support the podcast, please share it with others, post about it on social media, or leave a rating and review on Apple iTunes. To catch all the latest from Alex Atwood, you can check out his website at alexatwood.co. Thanks again, and we'll catch you next time at the Alchemist Lounge.